historians argue a great deal over how to define Puritanism and Puritans. It's obvious if you're going to say Jonathan Edwards was a Puritan, as a lot of people say that, and they say a lot of other people were, that you're giving some significant elasticity to the term. So we still really, we can't really agree on a clear definition.
We are back here on Roundtable, a podcast produced by Mid-America Reformed Seminary, here with a whole new topic to discuss, the Puritans. I'm Jared Luchabor, Manager of Marketing, Digital Media, and Publications here at the Seminary. Thanks for joining us. As we prepared for these recordings on Puritanism, we reflected a little bit on the surge of the Puritans in these last few decades. The following was pulled and paraphrased from the Banner of Truth Trust's website. In the 1950s, a group in England formed the Banner of Truth Trust to put books back in print that had become forgotten and hard to obtain. Ian Murray had been introduced to the writings of Robert Murray McShane, and since he found their writings so powerful, he sought out more authors of that era. The writings of the Puritans had been very influential in the lives of more recent figures like Whitefield and Spurgeon, and so Ian Murray and Sidney Norton longed to see such writings made more readily available to the church once again. So along with the magazine, The Banner of Truth, steps were taken in 1955 to try to put back in print some of these volumes from the past. There is now a treasury of Puritan writings in print, not only through Banner of Truth, but other publishers as well. Now there's been a revival of Puritans and Puritanism in the past half century. So the question we should be asking ourselves in this decade is, what should we know about Puritans so as to understand better their value for the church in the 21st century? Let's make room for our faculty of Mid-America here to help us out. You'll hear in speaking order Professor of Church History, Dr. Alan Strange, Old Testament Professor Reverend Andrew Compton, President of the Seminary and Professor of Doctrinal Studies Dr. Cornelis Venema, and our other Professor of Doctrinal Studies Dr. J. Mark Beach.
Well, if we're going to talk about the reappropriation and reappreciation of the Puritans, I think we need to talk about a general societal sort of misunderstanding of them over the course of time. In his day, this is back in 1916, for example, H.L. Mencken caustically defined Puritanism as the haunting fear that someone somewhere may be happy. And of course, he was thinking about the raging fundamentalist crisis of the time and was reading some of those particulars in light of this kind of caricature of Puritanism. And somebody then like Leland Ryken, many of our listeners would be familiar with, wrote a book a few years back called Worldly Saints, The Puritans as They Really Were. And that's just a more popular sort of book trying to, again, rehabilitate, if you will, the Puritans and get people to understand that while maybe 19th century Victorians, if that's even the case, were repressed in some ways, that's not really what characterized the Puritans. They were, many of them were vigorous in terms of their enjoyment of life and of food and of married intimacy and other things like that. But that also leads to, and I'll just say this, that leads to a problem of definition. Historians argue a great deal over how to define Puritanism and Puritans. It seems like Matthew Parker, the Archbishop of Canterbury, in the year Calvin died, 1564, was probably the first to use that particular name. And he didn't mean it as a compliment. He meant it as he considered these people who he called Puritans as rigorist, as precisionist. And the last time, many historians would agree that the last time it was probably properly used was in the 1640s with respect to those in Parliament who were opposing Charles I and who put him to death at the end of that decade. And that you really don't have the term meaning quite the same thing. So it's obvious if you're going to say Jonathan Edwards was a Puritan, as a lot of people say that, and they say a lot of other people were, that you're giving some significant elasticity to the term. So we can't really agree on a clear definition. I mean, we know certain things that Puritans were, but Puritanism and Puritanical tend to mean Pharisaical and self-righteous. And there is that strand, certainly, within the movement, because it's a very broad swath.
Just a couple of quotes Robert Godfrey has in one of the Puritan papers introductions, where he's noting some of these comments made about the title Puritan. I guess one from William Shakespeare, even one of the characters, "Marry, sir, sometimes he is a kind of Puritan." And the response, "Oh, if I thought that, I'd beat him like a dog." So there's not always the greatest comments. Even Shakespeare was writing that way. Or another song, "Pure in show, an upright holy man, corrupt within, and called a Puritan." So yeah, not good press for the term.
I do think that highlights what we want our listeners to be clear about. This is an English term, and it does refer to the English context. And here's what we need to remember: how the Reformation came about in England. The Reformation came about in England under Henry VIII in the 1530s. And it was a political, if not even to say a hormonal reformation with respect to the king, because it was throwing off the yoke of the Bishop of Rome and making the King of England the head of the church. And so you had people from the beginning who were interested in the church in England actually being reformed. And so, of course, Henry's son, who came to the throne in 1547 after his death, Edward VI, called affectionately by certain pious folk in England the Second Josiah. He was only nine and had a protectorate there. He began to really more reform the church. And that's where you first got the 42 articles, which will turn into the 39 articles. And the Church of England began to become something more of a reformed church. But he, who was the son of Jane Seymour, was succeeded. He died at the young age of 16. He may have had tuberculosis. He was succeeded by his oldest sister, Mary, who became Mary, Bloody Mary. She was in from 1553 to 58, and she returned England to Roman Catholicism. So when Elizabeth, her sister, who was Anne Boleyn's daughter, when she came to the throne in 1558, in 1559 and following, you had the religious settlement, and it gets described in the English context as a via media, a middle way, a broad church. It's not a Roman church, but it's not really a Reformed church. It's something in the middle. And so the original rise of the Puritans, the original rise, and Matthew Parker is referring to that, is this desire to further reform the English church. And you have the non-separating Puritans. Those are the Puritans who remain within the Episcopal Church. And they want to do away with the surplice, with crossing oneself, with creeping to the cross on Good Friday, all these kinds of things. And you have others, a main body of which, beginning in 1570 with Thomas Cartwright, want to have Presbyterianism. And so in addition to those Presbyterians, you have Congregationalists. Those are the people who come over. They won't establish Congregationalism, but separate congregational control. They come over and settle the Massachusetts Bay Colony. That's the so-called Puritans that come over in 1629 on the Arabella, John Winthrop. And before that, in 1620, those that came over had come from Scrooby, England, to Leiden in Holland, over to Plymouth. And those are the Pilgrims, and they were the Brownists. They were the separating type. They believed in a separation of church and state. But even there, I often will ask the students, which of all these parties were Baptists? Because a lot of our friends today who like Puritans are Baptists. Mm-hmm. And of course, the answer is none of these people are Baptists. They all baptize their kids. So you can see the concept that people often have of Puritanism isn't that clear. But these are the parties. That's a little bit of the history. They wanted to further reform the Church of England. Some wanted to go much further than others, but most wanted either a Reformed Episcopacy or Presbyterianism. That's what the significant majority wanted.
Well, this is Dr. Venema. I'm not a church historian in the way Alan is, but I do think one of the principal difficulties with the whole subject of Puritans and Puritanism is that the terminology can be used to describe a wide swath and spectrum of the degree to which the church should be reformed. And within the English context, the word has its most appropriate home, I think. It's really broadly synonymous with what we would say on the continent was the Reformation, the reform of the church in its confession, preaching, its understanding of the means of grace, church order, polity. So in its broad usage and meaning in an English context, the Puritans represent the best, you might say, of the 16th, early 17th century Reformation that occurred in the church on the continent. But no one would describe the continental reformers, the Reformation as it took place, for example, in the Netherlands, in the period up to and through the Synod of Dort, 1618-19, as a Puritan movement, if the terminology is being used in a narrower sense. If the terminology being used broadly for the Reformation of the Church in the Netherlands, complete with a reordering of the Church's polity, its confessional basis, and life and ministry, well, that was a Puritan Reformation. But there's another Reformation that occurs in the Netherlands subsequent to that period that is sometimes referred to as Dutch Puritanism. And that has its own unique, I think, flavor and characteristic. Maybe the other thing I would say in this connection is when there's a revival of interest in the Puritans and Puritanism in English-speaking circles today, oftentimes all people are talking about is some of the best writers and theologians of the Reformation period, whether it be in the British Isles or whether it be on the continent.
Sort of fitting into a broad label called Puritan, and they're adopting it, whether it accurately represents the right group.
Yeah, and you can track then, to pick up what Dr. Venema was saying, back to the English context, you can track these parties. I talk about separating and non-separating. What happens is when you come to 1643, July 1643 is the beginning of what will become the Westminster Assembly of Divines. And of course, well, I say of course, but it may not be that obvious. In September, there is a conclusion of the Solemn League and Covenant with the Scots. So the Scots join together with those English delegates of the Westminster Assembly. And you have it really is the parties that are there are Puritan parties largely. And again, that covers a wide spectrum. But they immediately have a big debate. The grand debate, as they call it, is over the specifics of church polity. Is it going to be Presbyterial government? Most agree pretty quickly that they don't want Episcopal government and they don't want Erastianism. Erastianism, of course, is the model kind of over against Rome. Rome teaches that the church is over the state. The Erastians say, no, the state is over the church. And we all know that sounder thinking, Calvin, as a great exemplar of that, rejected either of those and said, no, they're properly under God. I mean, Kuyper, of course, just to reach further in, is a great model of somebody who's understanding all the spheres as properly under the authority of God. But so at Westminster, you have the different parties there, and it is the Presbyterian Party that prevails, interestingly, in the assembly, but in terms of what's going on in the nation, Oliver Cromwell, who's leading the New Model Army and is fighting Charles I, is not persuaded in the Presbyterian direction. He is persuaded in the direction of independency, and so that never comes to play. The Westminster Assembly is never adopted, if you will, and made a part of the English church scene. It is with the Scottish church. It becomes the confessional base of the Scottish church, and then the American church, in 1729, you have the Adopting Act where they adopt that. So in that sense, you could say the best of Puritanism, and really what that means is Presbyterianism. Mm-hmm. But see, like Dr. Venom was saying, that's just what you had on the continent. I mean, whatever differences there may be between Calvin and Geneva and that polity and Presbyterianism, it's all Presbyterial. You're talking about there are flavor differences, but it's the same kind of thing. So what the church is, if you read what it says at Westminster in its prefatory material, they look back to Dort. Westminster sees Dort as the high watermark of international synodical Calvinism. They love that. And really, the best folk there want to be not some sort of narrow rigorists or precisionists, but they just want to be Calvinists. They want to be thoroughgoing Reformed people. And that is what's prevailing, and that prevails in the Scottish church.
Seems like one of the good impulses then of modern readers who want to read Puritans is that they're seeking out good Reformed writers. And yet, the problem is that they can too narrowly then parse out what constitutes a good Reformed writer if they use the word Puritan incorrectly.
Here I would ask a question. It'd be a provocateur, if you will. Is it actually true that what became known as English Puritanism, is it purely a matter of continuity from Calvin to Perkins to later Puritan writers? This is all of one fabric? Or is there a different set of concerns, a different sort of accents on doctrinal questions? And in fact, I think there is, so I'm tilting my hand. And it seems that modern people who find a great interest in Puritans, they might go to them for classic Reformed theology, which you can certainly find there. Mm-hmm. But they also seem to be quite interested in what has become known as experiential piety, pietism, the Christian life, the struggle of the Christian life, the battle of the Christian mm-hmm. life, sanctification, processes for sanctification, and maybe even a bit of a preoccupation with that topic that you don't find in an earlier codification of Reformed writers. So perhaps Dr. Strange or others want to comment on that.
Well, I agree with what you seem to clearly be saying there. I agree in this way. Both of you gentlemen, Doctors Beach and Venema, have written, and I've written, and many others have written, about, on the one hand, to answer that question, the essential sort of continuity between Calvin and the Calvinists, which would include the Puritans. In other words, folk like Perry Miller of Harvard, or to pick a much larger theological figure, Karl Barth, would want to pit the 16th century over against all of the scholasticism that followed in Protestantism. And a lot of that is Puritan. At least a part of that is what you would call Puritan. And so all of us here around this table, together with others, have said that that's misguided. There is a proper kind of continuity. But, as a historian, it's not just the same set of questions. You're absolutely right. There is development. It isn't just, it's not continuity of exact sameness. It's development. I mean, even in something as obvious, maybe a way that would get our listeners really into the question. I had a camera interview not long ago, so.
Who has the face for radio?
Yes. My agent told me I have the face for radio, so I'm back on a podcast. But assurance, and we could all get into that. I mean, look at the treatment of assurance in the confessional statements of the 16th century, in the theology, and then how it even gets treated at Westminster. And part of that, whatever you think about the whole development of it, part of it is just the fact that the Reformation as a whole is developing and moving on, and people are when Calvin and Luther were talking about assurance, they were doing so in a context where Rome said, I mean, that was what Rome and Trent aims at assurance more than justification, even in certain respects. They hate the doctrine of assurance. They think it's presumption. You cannot have assurance. And so Luther and Calvin see assurance as very much a part of faith in a certain respect, whereas Westminster wants to distinguish faith, which is believing and trusting in Jesus, and assurance, I believe that I believe and trust in Jesus. They want to distinguish it more. And part of that has to just do with the lived experience that's happened over the course of those decades. But I think also part of it has to do at points with things being a bit obsessive. In other words, I do think what develops in Puritanism, if I could put it this way, that even something like a healthy development of a biblical theology and a redemptive historical approach can address is a kind of focus, an over-focus, say, on ordo salutis and what can be in some circles a kind of theological, spiritual navel-gazing. Am I in? Am I out? Does he love me? Does he not? In ways that you don't see that in Calvin, in some ways that aren't healthy. I know my own personal experience in my early Christian life. I was in an independent, Baptistic, Calvinistic church and spent many sleepless nights battling over the question of whether I'm the elect or not. And I came to not only be a Presbyterian, but I came to see that that's a fruitless way of going about it. And one of the things that really helped me to better situate this question was to have a better understanding of redemptive history and biblical theology and to understand the work of Christ on our behalf and not to be monomaniacal about my own religious experience. You can be so focused on your religious experience that it's unhealthy. And there's no small part of Puritanism that's a part of. Is that part of what you're talking about, Ethan?
Well, it strikes me because the Reformation couldn't get off the ground without the help of the government, German princes, the powers that be with an army behind them to protect them. From the start, we had a situation in which the church came under the protection of the sword in various places, which also then came to define what faith was practiced in a given location, which also then breeded a kind of folks church, a kind of, you know, if you're in Geneva, you're going to be Reformed, period. And if you're, you know, in Holland, at least the recognized state-supported faith is the Reformed faith. Well, all of this, I think, bred rather a formalistic, outward, perfunctory kind of Christianity under the banner of Reformation. And I see Puritanism, both whether it's Puritanism in England, Pietism in Germany, the Nadere Reformatie in the Netherlands, they're all trying to get at authentic,
right,
real converted Christianity. But that has its own hazards, right. it strikes.
Because the nation and the church are identified in all these places. And
right.
What you got back with just the Lutherans back in 1555, the Peace of Augsburg, cuius regio, eius religio, whose region, his religion. In other words, the prince is very determinant of what the faith is. And then the Calvinists get added in at the end of the Peace of Westphalia, at the end of the Thirty Years' War. So you're going to want to define the church not just in terms of, well, everybody's baptized here, so everybody's a Christian. And the Puritans are saying, wait a minute, there's a lot of nominal Christianity,
right,
which is true. But then if you're always concerned about, well, am I just a nominal Christian or am I a real Christian? That can really grind you down, all the way down.
Well, that's one of my concerns, and I think a lot of people have had concerns that way. While appreciating the Puritans, there's a strand within Puritanism, certainly a strand within the broader movement of Pietism, in which you have to give so much attention to assurance because somehow you're breeding a lack of assurance, trying to fight off a perfunctory Christianity. Somehow you've introduced a doubting Christian Christianity.
It is interesting how the Puritans are, in some ways, really praised for cultivating a humility and self-suspicion, and yet how that can go pretty far. It can turn into a morbid introspection, something that we unfortunately find ourselves correcting in counseling a lot.
I was in a communion that made a virtue of doubt.
Wow.
I mean, it was open. I mean, we want to address doubt. I mean, I think the way doubt gets addressed, you know, may one who doubts come to the communion. That's a beautiful answer in the larger catechism, question 172. It's a beautiful answer. But then it's not something, it's dealing with somebody who's genuinely doubting and who is weak. And it's saying that, you know, this is medicine for sin-sick souls. Come and take it. But then you don't wish to inculcate. I was in a communion that you were, every sermon the preacher said one time, I want to preach so that everybody questions. He said this in an interview. I want to preach so that everybody questions whether they're really a Christian, and the true Christians will crawl back to the cross.
Boy, boy.
That's what he said.
Well, that certainly gives us a good set of things to grapple with as we continue our conversation on the Puritans next time on Roundtable, particularly taking a look at the legacy of the Puritans and their impact on us today. Look for a release on December 1st. Take care until then. Thanks for joining us.